here just as the weather, you know, and we understand that. So we're going to move ahead and move through our agenda today. I'd like to begin by opening a work session for possible introduction of committee bills, and I'll have Janet give a very brief discussion of these. As you know, members, these are bills that we've just been asked to introduce that will go into the process. We may or may not even have these bills in our committee, and voting to put them in the process does not indicate support or rejection. But I would like to have Janet just give us a brief summary of the bills and ask that we move them into the process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 1140 has to do with the treatment of guide dogs and is at the request of the Guide Dog Association. Senate Bill 1430, related to manufactured structures and documents related to registration of manufactured structures, adds information that would be helpful to county assessors, and it's at the request of county assessors and county tax collectors. LC 1620 takes out some outdated language having to do with horse racing days, and it's at the request of the Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, as is LC 1621, which changes the percentage of money retained by the Oregon Racing Commission, and LC 1870 has to do when corrections of violations and payments of civil penalties are required under occupational safety and health laws, and it's at the request of the Oregon self-insurers.
Okay. So, members, I would entertain a motion to introduce LC 1140, 1430, 1620, 1621, and 1871 as committee bills.
So moved.
Senator Starr has moved the introduction of LCs 1140, 1430, 1620, 1621, and 1871 as committee bills. Any discussion?
Can we do them all individually?
Thank you very much for that suggestion, but as you know, we're going to get out in June instead of August this time, Senator.
Okay, I won't vote no against the horse.
Okay, any other discussions? Okay, no objections? All right, so.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, is that both horsemen?
All
horse peoples.
All horse peoples, yeah.
Both horse peoples?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 182. Janet, let's get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 182 authorizes the Board of Accountancy to allow public accounting firms extensions of time in order to meet an existing requirement that a majority of firm ownership belong to licensed accountants. The changes are at the top of page 2 on the bill, adding a new section, and again about accountancy firms, not individual accountants, and how they are registered. Carol Reese from the agency is here to explain the bill and to answer any questions.
Okay, Ms. Reese, would you please come forward?
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity for the Board of Accountancy to discuss our bill, Senate Bill 182. It's a fairly easy bill. And I had some information that I guess the committee administrator is providing for you now. This bill will provide greater flexibility for public accounting firms to meet the ownership requirements of public accounting firms. Historically, public accounting firms were owned only by licensed certified public accountants or licensed public accountants. In recent years, however, public accounting firms have expanded the services and diversified services that are provided to clients. This diversification of services has allowed the public accounting firms and the clients to utilize the knowledge and expertise of their current public accountant and use that knowledge to meet the additional needs of the clients, which may or may not be traditional public accounting services. Diversification of the services has also allowed public accounting firms to be more competitive. Recognizing the need to provide expertise in those service areas that are non-traditional public accounting services has caused public accounting firms to increase their staff so that they can provide the experience and the expertise that is necessary for these non-public accounting services. State Boards of Accountancy also acknowledge this transition in the public accounting firm business needs by relaxing the firm ownership requirements. The requirement for 100% licensee ownership of a public accounting firm was modified in Oregon by the 1999 legislative session and went into effect in the year 2000. And it requires that licensees own no less than 51% of the firm. However, 51-49 ownership percentage presents a delicate balance that can easily be upset without warning to the public accounting firm. It is these situations that the board wishes to address with Senate Bill 182. In situations when the required 51% licensee ownership is disrupted because of unanticipated circumstances, for example, the death of a licensee owner, perhaps the disability of a licensee owner, or hopefully not the revocation of a licensee owner, would reduce the percentage owned by licensees, and suddenly they would no longer be in compliance with the 51% ownership requirement. So it is this circumstance that the board wishes to address by implementing an administrative rule that would allow a reasonable time for public accounting firms to bring their ownership balance back into the required percentages. It would not apply in situations when a licensee merely retires or in a situation when someone initially registers for a public accounting firm registration. Those needs must be planned for and must be met as required. The provision for non-licensee ownership does maintain public protection because it assures that business decisions relating to the practice of public accountancy and those that relate to the non-accounting services provided by the firms remains in the hands of licensees who are subject to the requirements of professional standards and of the professional code of conduct. I would be happy to address any questions. The packet that you received should have a copy of the proposed administrative rule if you'd like to look at the provisions. What the board is proposing is to allow 180 days to meet this requirement or until the next firm renewal period, whichever of those terms is a longer period of time.
Thank you, Ms. Reese. I remember doing a similar bill a few years ago. You may have personally met with the owner of dental offices.
Oh, I see.
Although I think that one we actually removed the 51-49 requirement that the licensed dentist actually owned. But certainly with a lot of the same issues of yours when the dentist would die and out of compliance. The only question I would have is just as a curious one. Obviously, this is an issue because of the incidents, potential incidents that you have mentioned, and it would seem logical that some of those have taken place. I've just kind of wondered how has the department handled that up to this point without the ability to do that. I mean, have you kind of looked the other way until it got taken care of, or did people actually end up losing licenses because of those types of situations?
No, there has only been, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. There's only been one instance that we are aware of that has been brought to our attention when a public accounting firm did not meet the ownership requirements because one of the licensees had died, and the board allowed them an extension of time of, I think, like 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
We asked them what was reasonable, what did they see as a possible time that would allow them to come into compliance, and 90 days they agreed would help them. In this way, you know, their services, the business is not disrupted, and the client needs continue to be served as well. Typically, if a public accounting firm submits a renewal form that indicates that they're in any way not in compliance, their firm is immediately terminated, which means they can't provide continuing services to their clients or any other services. So this provision helps to prevent that result.
Right.
But we have only had one situation, and the board simply handled it on a single instance, and that was the reason to think about this bill.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate that. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We don't have anybody else set to testify, although, unless you know somebody that has, since we talked. Although we did have conversations with those who represent the CPAs and were comfortable with the legislation.
Thank you.
If not, then I would close the public hearing on Senate Bill 182 and open a work session on 182.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 182 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 182 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. First bill. Maybe we can get that somehow to our committee member, Senator George, in some capacity for the first bill.
I think we should carry that.
Let's ask Senator George to be the carrier of that.
He was really fascinated by the
piece of legislation.
Important bill.
Yeah. All right, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 193. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 193 has to do with boilers, pressure vessels, and hot water heaters. It would, in single-family dwellings, currently there are some new kinds of water heaters that are actually considered legally to be boilers, and so they are subject to inspection by the state as boilers, and that is probably not necessarily appropriate, so this bill would make certain water heaters that are used in homes subject to municipal building inspection, but instead of state inspection. The bill also cleans up a number of statutes, deletes some statutes, and makes instead the department would adopt rules, or the Board of Boiler Rules would adopt rules for inspections, including inspection frequencies. One other change is that the inspectors who are employed by boiler insurers, that they would have to perform all the inspections that are required by the state if they're going to be insured by that company. There's additional clarifying changes, and the bill does declare an emergency and take effect on passage. Mark Long is here to explain the provisions of the bill. I understand there's amendments needed, and they're not have not been turned in or prepared. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Long, please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. For the record, Mark Long, I'm the Administrator of Building Codes Division. We're a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senate Bill 193 is a pre-session bill of our department. It does several things, as Janet went through. To provide you a little bit of background on our boiler program, during the interim, we conducted a program review from an outside consultant to help us look at the operation of the organization, address some concerns that were brought forward to us from industry. And this bill is the result of some of those efforts. And I'm going to kind of walk through what we're trying to accomplish, but our hope is, at the end of the day, it's going to allow us to operate more efficiently, prioritize our work, and kind of focus on the higher risks to the public, the real safety concerns that we have with some of the boiler equipment out there on an ongoing basis. So the first thing that we're trying to do within this bill is allow local governments to inspect these water heaters that, just because of technology and changes in the marketplace, are now classified as boilers, and you would think of them as water heaters. These are things like tankless water heaters, InstaHots that are now going in homes. Those technically are boilers and require a state inspector to come out to your home or a homeowner's home and to inspect those, as well as the local government inspector who's looking at the potable water system and all the other pieces with the home. And we think that for these simple pieces, just because they provide a greater level of BTU rating, the input rating, that this should be done by local government, not be subject to state regulation. That's the first thing.
Second thing, Mr. Chair?
Yes,
just a quick, is there a fee?
Currently?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mons-Anderson, yes. Through the state, there's a fee, and I assume that through local government, if they were to do it, that there would be a permit fee there as well.
Thank you.
The second thing that we're trying to do is, just to give you more background on the boiler program, currently about 60% of the inspections that are done in the state of Oregon are done by insurance companies. Businesses elect to insure their boilers if they choose, and may choose to have the insurance companies, particular companies, provide those inspections for them, which means the state doesn't have to come out and do that. We're asking the insurance companies that if they take on that account with that particular business owner, that they provide all the inspections as opposed to deferring some of those to the state. And what's been happening is kind of not knowing what we're responsible for causes an administrative effort on our part. Do we have the account? Is it state responsibility? Is it insurance company responsibility? Are part of the inspections done by the insurance company? Are they done by the state? We'd like the insurance companies to do it. If they don't, then of course we'll pick up the pieces, but we really would prefer that folks don't pick and choose, the insurance companies pick and choose which inspections they do. I've been informed that there's some concern to that, and that's probably a particular area that we need to make some amendments to clarify what our intent is, because there's undoubtedly some broad impacts that have been brought to my attention here just recently, and so we'll be working with the insurance industry on that. The third thing that we're trying to accomplish is this bill allows us to provide an exemption for boiler equipment if we find that there isn't a life and safety concern. Right now, under our regulatory structure, and this would fall into kind of the regulatory streamlining aspect, if it's defined as a boiler, we have to inspect it, or the insurance company. It's regulated by the state. And so it's permit, it's licensed, it's inspected, the products are approved. And we think there are particular pieces of equipment that come to our attention that maybe we want to exempt it. Maybe we want to exempt it from the licensing standpoint, but only have an inspection. Maybe you don't need to have an inspection because it's installed by a licensed contractor. Maybe it can be partially exempted instead of fully regulated. We provided this authority to the electrical board some time ago, and they've used it very well when new technology comes in, wind generation equipment, high-tech manufacturing equipment that we worked with Intel on many years ago, where the regulatory structure says regulate it all and or exempt it all, and maybe you want to exempt just bits and pieces of it. So this gives us additional tools in our tool chest to really look at whether there's a life safety concern, and if there isn't, maybe we can provide some exemptions and not regulate that piece of equipment. And then the last thing that we're trying to do, and this builds on the success of a bill that we had last session in our elevator program, where currently in the boiler statutes, the inspection frequency is set by statute. And as equipment changes and the need changes, we think that that should be done by administrative rules, so that if you don't need to go out annually to a particular piece of equipment, maybe that could be a two-year inspection or a three-year inspection or a four-year inspection. We successfully worked with our industry in the elevator world to take the annual inspection that was required by statute before last session and work out an administrative inspection frequency. We want to do that in boilers as well. We think, again, these four things help us prioritize our work, focus on real safety issues, and allow us to operate as efficiently as possible. I'll be happy to take any questions that you have. Again, it does need some amendments, and I have heard some concerns over the insurance piece. This afternoon, we'd be happy to sit down and with folks and discuss that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Law. Questions for Mr. Law? Well, I think we may have some questions. I think what we'll do is I'll ask Mr. Monroe to come forward. And Mr. Cross, why don't you come forward as well if he's here. There he is. And who have all signed up for testimony. I think we're going to hear some of those issues, and that might prompt some additional ones. So, and we'll start with Mr. Monroe, who represents, I believe, representing the insurance industry today.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, representing the American Insurance Association. And obviously, I assume none of us have had many discussions about boilers in the course of our respective legislative careers, but
it's a hot topic usually in our conversation.
I know it really is. I'm sure that you're discussing it over lunch frequently. It's from an insurance perspective, it's a specialty kind of operation, as you can imagine, and there are a limited number of insurers who write these risks, but we certainly within the AIA membership have some of those companies. We have absolutely no problems with the bill in general, with the exception of one subsection, and that is Section 7, Subsection 2. And as Mr. Long indicated to you, it deals with the activities of special inspectors. And there are really two kinds of special inspectors, one kind being those employed by insurance companies, and then there are also provisions in the statute for owners of boilers to have an employee who has this designation. People who are special inspectors have to meet the same experience and certification requirements that deputy inspectors that are members of the state workforce have to meet. The crux of the problem is that the existing language, if you look at it, is permissive. It authorizes special inspectors to do a range of inspections. The language that's offered here says that you'll perform all applicable inspections that are insured or being considered for an insurance. And there are two basic problems with that language. And let me deal first with the being considered. This language seems to set up a requirement for what I will call pre-underwriting inspections of all boilers and pressure vessels that a particular insured might have before you've even made the decision to cover them. Insurance in this area generally isn't written as what I will call a monoline coverage. You go out, you get a specific insurer who does your boilers. You're generally packaging boiler and machinery insurance with commercial liability and commercial property and commercial vehicle and maybe even workers' comp related coverages or whatever it is you might need. And you might have a situation, let's say, well, let's take an example. Let's take Weyerhaeuser that has facilities all over the country, many of which have boilers or pressure vessels. When the negotiation is going on between a broker and the risk manager, or whatever the title might be, a Weyerhaeuser, to buy a package of insurance that happens to include boiler coverage, there isn't any discussion about exactly how many boilers are in Springfield or wherever else it is. And you might ask, why is that true? It's true because predominantly the inspection process, and because the insurer knows that that virtually all insureds have an interest in maintaining their boilers. Because, I mean, if a boiler goes down, production goes down, if there's an accident, people are injured, etc. So it's not a discussion point at that moment. And this language, the net result of it, if you had to do pre-underwriting inspections, it would just be way too cumbersome and way too costly for any of the parties in the system to absorb. There's no other state, I'm told, that has any language similar to this. So, and I think with good reason. The second problem that we see here relates to the issue that Mark raised about doing all of the inspections. And I would say, Mr. Long and I have not had much of an opportunity to chat about this. We were not part of whatever the evaluation that occurred during the interim, and we clearly want to work with Mr. Long and whoever else it might be to see if we can define the problem and work our way out of it. But the second problem is the all applicable inspections. And there are different kinds of inspections. I mean, there's an installation inspection, there's what's called a service inspection, which is the annual or biannual inspection just to make sure that everything is working. And then there are repair inspections. If there's been a problem and it's been repaired, it's a different kind of inspection. These are all different kinds of inspections, and in many cases, take the example of a repair inspection, it requires different industry certification. There's something called an R stamp, which means if I were a deputy inspector or a special inspector and had an R stamp, I could do these repair inspections. Insurers in this area don't necessarily have somebody in a particular geographic area and may not have them at all who are qualified to do certain of the various inspections. And so, we also see this as being a significant problem. I mean, you know, if you don't have the certificate, you don't have the stamp, then you couldn't do it. If you couldn't do it, then you couldn't satisfy an all inspections kind of requirement. So, the bottom line is both of those areas are problems. We will look forward to working with Mr. Long to see if we can find our way through the maze. And with that, I'd obviously be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, well, I think I'll do it. I do have a couple questions. But just so we have all possible questions on the table, before we do that, let's go to Mr. Cross, and then we'll go for the question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today representing the Oregon Building Officials Association, and they represent the local city and county building departments that would be impacted by Section 5, subsection 4 and 5, which is at the bottom of page 8. And as Mr. Long indicated, the state would like local jurisdictions to perform the inspections for basically residential pressure vessels, boilers, water heaters. And these would be the types where we're going to be asked to do an inspection at installation or at alteration or repair, not periodic inspections like Jack was talking about with commercial and industrial boilers. And with that provision, we're comfortable. As Mr. Long pointed out, our inspectors are out on the sites looking at the other aspects of the plumbing and electrical that you've got surrounding the installation of these vessels. So they're out there, and this wouldn't be a big leap for the local jurisdictions to go ahead and inspect the water heaters and the pressure vessels. So that's the limit of my remarks in terms of speaking in support of the provisions in Section 5, subsections 4 and 5.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cross. Mr. Long, you brought up in your testimony part of the streamlining is that this would help solve an issue that you brought up of the insurance companies perhaps cherry picking some of the of the inspections for whatever reason, and then you having to do the others. Would you give me an example of what you mean by that, and then I'll have Mr. Monroe comment on that, so I can get a kind of a feeling of what the concern is here.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and I do want to make sure that, you know, it's entirely possible in the way that the language has been proposed that we've created unintended concerns for the insurance industry. We want to work through those. But our main concern is, and just to give you an example, last year in the state of Oregon, there were 2,300 new boilers installed. These are rough numbers, okay?
We're talking about commercial now.
What's that?
Commercial.
Across the state.
Okay.
Commercial residential.
Yeah.
945 of those installations were made in businesses that have covered insurance for presumably the periodic or the annual operating inspection that we've talked about. Only 119 of those were actually performed by that insurance company in those particular areas. And for the new installation, we think that the insurance companies that are doing the periodic inspections have the expertise and the ability to do that new install. Anyway, roughly 85% or whatever the math is there, the covered sites were sent back to the state for some particular reason for then us to pick up. And similar to the concerns that Mr. Monroe communicated, the state has the same difficulty in making sure that we can provide those timely inspections and be on top of issues. And we think it's reasonable. And for that particular piece, we have found examples in other states where for the new installation, repair and maintenance gets a little more complicated with the R stamp and the O stamp and all the other different things that the boiler program will take you through. But for the new installation, which is the primary concern, we think it would be reasonable to ask insurance companies to, if you're going to have that account, if you're covering the other piece, go ahead and do those pieces as well and not send that back to the state. So that's kind of what we're talking about.
Okay, and then Mr. Monroe pointed out a concern, and whether it's in the language or concern that it may be interpreted in the language about the pre-inspection issue, which is a concern that people in his industry may have to be responsible for an inspection for a client who necessarily may not be a client at that particular time. And is that, assuming this is a language issue, is there any policy issue with that you have a concern about?
Sure, no. That would obviously not be the first points that Mr. Miller talked about, and if our language has created that problem, we want to fix that. That's not our intent to ask insurance companies to pick up a requirement for someone else's work or those types of things. We're asking them to perform the services in which they're actually insuring or providing those services for. And like I said, they're out there at the sites doing the annual inspections, or 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, whatever it happens to be, and a new boiler comes in, we think it's reasonable to go ahead and pick up that new boiler as well under their special inspection provision.
Mr. Monroe, you want to comment on that assessment?
Yeah, I guess a couple of general comments. And I think Mr. Long and I obviously need to sit down. We've had a sort of a sidebar conversation here. And in some ways, I'm getting the feeling that it's more of a sort of logistics issue in terms of they're not knowing. I mean, when somebody sends in a form that says they're insured, and in fact they are for all of the, you know, the boilers that exist in multiple plants and multiple locations, and then suddenly they put in a new one, you know, that doesn't send the right signal to Mr. Long's boiler people. And so, you know, there's a question then about whether it's inspected, and I think we need to work through that. But from a policy standpoint, it seems to me that, of course, any inspection that occurs and is done by an insurance company special inspector who has an interest in making sure that boiler didn't blow up, is an inspection that doesn't have to be done by a state employee. Now, as I've already pointed out, I guess, you know, there are different kinds of inspections that are required for an installation or repair than for an in-service annual inspection. The issue that I will need to go back, I guess, because it's buried in your question and buried in Mr. Long's statement, I don't know, for example, how significant the difference might be between what's required by way of professional certification for some inspector that's doing installation inspections than is the case with, you know, an in-service operational kind of annual, and I that's something I'll have to find out, and I'll certainly provide that information to you.
And just Mr. Chair, I mean, this obviously is something that we had a chance to speak on about yesterday, and so to be fair to Mr. Monroe, we do need to sit down, and we don't want to create an unintended problem in some of those areas that he talked about, but we also would like to have that discussion about the if you're going to cover it, then, you know, help us kind of manage that workflow better, because it puts the state at a disadvantage. And frankly, we believe we can spend our time making sure that the higher risk boilers are being inspected, whether it's by us or insurance companies, on time and thoroughly. And that's what we're trying to do with this element as well as the other elements of the bill. So we'll get our heads together and figure out where we're at. Hopefully we can work that piece out.
Questions by the committee?
Senator Decker.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair. But, Jack, you had mentioned, and surprisingly, I, by leading off, said most of us have never engaged in this boilerplate, and up until about a year and 2 months ago, neither had I. Now I have. I had a constituent who, and I think he comes more from Bill's arena. Of one was a manufacturer of boiler, and the other was, I think, a building owner or a consumer. And I believe they're represented on the boiler board. I'm astonished that I remember this, but I think those representatives are represented. And the only thing that registered. That I still recall from all of those discussions, or at least one of the two things, was one, a need for both building owners and large industries who have a number of big boilers. A, there's the safety issue, but B, it's just timely inspection and the concern. And there seemed to be a good effort being made both by the consumer, which is the businesses, and the state to marry those two. And there seemed to be understaffed at the state level was the understanding I had, and so I guess I'm encouraged that there's some efforts to think this through a year later of how do we expedite many folks who are just waiting to get the approval that they need to keep building and keep going. So at least the spirit of the bill is actually I think important, that we expedite it and we find better ways than what we had been doing.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator Deckert, and I think what Mr. Long is trying to do, and I think the committee certainly appreciates, is trying to streamline. If you're imagining you're in that situation and you find out there's all these different players that may or may not have to sign off, in the meantime, you're just trying to move forward to the extent that you can certainly resolve some of the issues. here, but so that the consumer also has a clear pathway to conclusion is a desirable outcome. Other questions?
Just one.
Yes, Senator Stark.
I just want to make real sure that we're not creating new requirements for property owners as it relates to a water heater that's in a single family house. It goes out. They don't get it. They go out to George Moreland and pick up a new one and bring it in. And that doesn't fall under any of this. That's not what we're talking about, right?
Mr. Chairman, no. What we're trying to do is actually fix an existing problem. I don't want to belabor this conversation necessarily, but there are types of equipment now that are going in single-family homes, and just because they provide more power, if you will, more hot water capacity, more heating capacity for the hot water system, now are classified as a boiler and are supposed to be inspected by my staff. We don't think that's, and I'm not saying that he should do it either, we don't think it's necessary. Bill's folks are out there already looking at the water heater, and we think it doesn't make much sense to have a local government inspector there and a state person there charging the consumer both fees. We think we can pull out of it and ask the local government folks to do that.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So we're actually, I think, addressing it.
Well, thank you for the legislation. We do want to move forward because I think it is the right process is to streamline and narrow the not only from the fee standpoint, but also just the problem. So we'll ask that Mr. Monroe and Mr. Long, you talk, and so in an expeditious manner to try to clarify the issues that were brought up so that the responsibilities are understood and agreed to. Then we'll come back with that amendment and move the bill further at that point. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 193. Senator George has joined us. Hope the car is still in the same configuration it was when you left.
Senator Metzger, I had a dentist appointment, and I apologize.
All right.
I swear I won't be late again.
But you came in safely.
I promise, yes.
Yeah. So if Senator George, you know, sounds like he's not talking clearly, you'll understand that there's a reason for that. All right. So we've closed the public hearing on 193, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 150. Chair Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 150 establishes a mezzanine financing fund within the state treasury for financing certain loans to Oregon businesses, as well as to fund a direct royalty financing program. Another account is established in the bill, the multi-bank account, and this would be for to pool established any money that's put in by established commercial financial institutions with a state-funded portion for credit enhancement. There's a number of restrictions and intentions in the bill for what these funds could go for and amounts and where the funding would come from. And Mike Salzgiver from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department is here to explain the provisions of the bill. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. And we also have Jeff Wargren here also in support, so why don't the both of you come up? Welcome. Tell us why this is really important and go from there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for having us. For the record, Mike Salzgiver, Deputy Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Joining me is my colleague, our business finance manager, John Wargren. And John is the technical expert, and I'm sure would be happy to answer anything that I fumble. So I appreciate the opportunity to join you this afternoon to discuss this bill. First of all, set the stage a little bit. Our agency in the interim has gone through a rather significant review of all of our programs and activities, and among those many things we did was a full review of all of our statutes. And there's a separate bill, Senate Bill 350, that has a number of changes that will come undoubtedly before you at some point. But this is a bill that came out of a separate process that we would have proposed to the governor for consideration and submission regardless. And In November of 2005, the department sponsored a survey of capital needs around the state that concluded that among the top three highest unmet needs in Oregon in the financial community was the need for mezzanine capital. And just to picture it, mezzanine is kind of that floor between one and two that few people go to. It's not a standalone on its own type of financing, but it fills a gap. And during the what this financing fills is the gap between high-risk, high-return venture capital and low-risk, low-return bank financing. During the survey, lenders around the state ranked mezzanine programs as their highest need, and businesses that we surveyed strongly supported the need for low-interest loans and this type of financing. The proposal has received generally very positive comments for some form of mezzanine or royalty financing based on either direct private investment and or the development of a public-private partnership to facilitate that type of investment. The discussions have taken place over the last 9 months and have involved a number of organizations that would include the Network for Affordable Housing, NOAA, the Oregon Bankers Association, and the Oregon Bankers Association's Lending Committee, the Oregon State Treasury, all of the economic development districts around the state, the Oregon Innovation Council, as well as our own Economic Development Commission and the Department's Finance Committee, which is made up of financiers from around the state that review our bonding and other financing work. So although the original department concept included the potential for an OECD direct loan program, there is greater support, we have found, for the development of a private lender or lenders to fill the financing gap rather than a direct financing program through the department. A second, more popular option involves the implementation of some form of public-private partnership. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we understand that there are some ongoing issues around this bill. We look forward to working both with you and other members who have expressed interest in those concerns. There remains a need, we have found and substantiated through the survey, that additional mezzanine financing for Oregon businesses and OECD staff continues to meet with private lenders and investors to discuss the broader availability of mezzanine financing. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any general questions you have, or Mr. Wargren is here to answer your technical questions.
Thank you. First of all, I'll ask Mr. Wargren, do you have anything you would like to add at this point?
Mr. Chair, committee, I'd be happy to respond to any questions. I think that generally summarizes a process that we've been engaged in for several months and that we're continuing to try to refine.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'll start off. The first question that you probably have had and would be asked is, why should the state be using lottery funds to provide financing to private businesses if the private market hasn't seen fit to do so, whether it's for new products, rollouts, and if that is not available for whatever underwriting decisions private institutions, why would the state do that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, very good question. It's one that Senator Johnson, Betsy Johnson, who is an ex officio member of our commission, has asked. In general, one of the reasons that the agency is involved in these programs is to either buffer private lenders against higher levels of risk or to provide financing on ventures that the state has deemed important to the economy, and we will support those and pursue them. And so in general, what this would probably do is, what we're recommending is to set up or use about $5 million of lottery fund to capitalize this program, possibly as a loan loss reserve, or in some cases for direct, slightly higher risk financing. We're not interested in being venture capitalists. We're not really interested in being bankers. And in many cases, what we found with our programs is that some of the more successful ones have been where we go through working with our business finance team in working through a a package, and then finding out that a private lender actually does want to take on the risk and does want to do the direct financing. In the end, we are a backstop. That's the general intention. But we're also there to move forward business ventures that we find drive the mission, which is to advance the state's economy and also to drive the investment of capital or investment in new programs that are move forward on creating higher wage, higher leverage jobs in the state.
Where do you see the primary underwriting being done of the business plan? Would that be, do they go to your department and present that plan? Do you take a plan like that and have some mechanism for having it have a review by, you know, private financial institutions before you would make a decision on what role you would have? How would that process work?
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I think Mr. Wargren's better. He deals with that every day, so I'll turn it over to him for that.
Mr. Chair, committee, we have a number of financing programs, as you're aware of, and as I think about those and I look at the way this is done in some of the other states like Texas and Arizona and New Jersey, it's done different in different states. In Texas and New Jersey, they have Arizona and Texas, they have a multi-bank program where they have at least 10 banks that are participating. They do anything from, in some cases, from housing to business financing, and from mezzanine royalty type financing to something that's more like venture capital financing. In the case, I think, of New Jersey, they have a select committee of PhDs supported by universities and so forth that pre-screen these applicants, and they have a very high success rate. One of the areas that we need to focus attention on, depending on what form this finally takes here in Oregon, is to have a technical review as well as a market review. So much of these financings are projecting revenues and trying to anticipate rapid sales growth and maybe new product development. So there needs to be those technical reviews. One of the things we've thought about is the Oregon Innovation Council, the Treasurer's Office, and others have committees and individuals that review different proposals for their sources of funds, and we would anticipate partnering with them and with universities where we can. The University of Oregon, for example, has a mezzanine course that they've started for students. So I think there are folks out there that are willing and able and have already volunteered to try to work with us as this comes together. So there needs to be not only the financial underwriting, but the technology review and the market understanding as we go forward.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess back to Chair Metzger's question, I guess from my perspective, I'm having a little hard time identifying in my mind the types of firms that would use this type of financing, specifically because of the fact that we already have a number of programs already in place to provide finance, and then you have the federal government with the SBA and others that will allow pretty significant size loans with support of those who are underwriting the loans. So I'm trying to figure out a little bit about where this niche is that we're missing in that financing. If you could be more specific, I'd really appreciate it. Maybe an example of some firms.
Yes, and one of the things that Chairman Metzger, Senator George, when this was originally adopted or presented, I guess, as a potential bill, we tried to do a full range of a presentation, anything from direct financing to a public-private partnership in terms of how we approach this. And over the last several months, we've been kind of running that trap line and talking to a lot of people to see what might fit best for Oregon. In our day-to-day work, we do partnering with banks, primarily on the business finance side. Deals come to us because they're not quite bankable or the borrower needs something extra that bank can't do. We partner with those banks. In case of our OBDF program, which is a direct loan program, we do up to 40%
of financing on a deal, another financial institution, a bank usually does that finance. So we're partnering on a regular daily basis. Out of that has come examples that neither we, under our current statutes and rules, could address nor the bank could address. But there was, and it really didn't fall into the realm of what an angel investor or a venture capitalist would do. It was a typical business, might be someone who's already established, wants to develop a new product line that's not quite bankable. They're able to come up with some of the funds, but they need additional financing. They really don't want to place themselves in a situation where they need to give up part of their company, where the outcome is maybe a sale to somebody else, maybe a move out of the state or an IPO or something like that. They're looking for financing that that is a little riskier than the standard deal we do now. An example, just recently, was a manufacturer who designs water sprayers for helicopters to fight forest fires. And there was a they wanted to transfer a technology from an overseas company, and they really needed to go through a series of steps to change that, develop a new product. And so there was, they needed to integrate technologies, they needed to build a prototype, and then they needed to get the certifications for that. All of those things kind of needed to be done before they could apply for sort of what you might call standard bank financing. And it was small enough that it really didn't attract a venture capital company and have something like a royalty mezzanine financing where you could see the market opportunity, the technology made sense, there was an opportunity for rapid growth in sales, so that as getting a percentage of that sales to repay that loan is really the hallmark of this mezzanine royalty financing. So that would be a typical example, as opposed to sort of early stage seed capital kinds of financing, which you can do with royalty as well.
And again, to follow up on Senator Metzger's question, and explain to me why it is, from your perspective, that the private sector isn't currently filling this gap, because it seems like to me that what we're asking the state to do is take on some additional risks that the private sector is unwilling to. Explain to me why you don't think that with the current kind of supply of capital out there where bank loans are very reasonable compared to historical levels, and then you have all kinds of different financing out there, why is it that there is not a niche for this currently existing in the private sector?
Senator George, we're asking the same question. In fact, we've been, the focus of our effort over the last several weeks and months was to try to find an existing organization that would, that was clear to us that they'd be taking on that additional risk and solving that gap. We haven't concluded that effort. We have a meeting with Shore Bank, for example, who does royalty-type mezzanine financing in the fish processing business. And we're planning to explore with them and with others, as we've talked to NOAA, for example, hoping that they would want to go beyond their housing expertise and get into more of a broader business where they would take the lead, and we could encourage the banks to put up maybe $4 million, and we would have $1 million reserve from our OBDF fund to cover losses to encourage them to do that. And we had some pretty good conversations. They finally decided a couple of weeks ago that they really wanted to stick with housing, their main business. And so we're continuing to look for organizations and hoping that we don't have to create a brand new one like they did in Texas and Arizona, that there might be somebody that would champion this and take it on, and we're still exploring that.
The questions? Senator Deckard and Senator Starr.
Mike, this may be a question for you. To me, I mean, the whole idea of the Innovation Council or Oregon Inc. was less. We've got OGA, I forget the Senate bill that did the tax incentive program last time that we're going to refine most likely this time. And then within the Innovation Council, we had that Capital Formation Committee, which really was, a good cross-section of the venture capital, the traditional lending committee, our lenders in the state. And the whole drive seemed to be, let's get less, let's take a lot of what Oregon has done and put it into a couple places. And I don't remember this being in the capital formation conversation. It was certainly is was the topic of discussion with folks that know more than I'll ever know in a minute about this field. And so I guess that's the only concern I have is that we've been driving to do less, get everything in one place for these type of decisions. And I just don't remember it being a recommendation of the Capital Formation Committee, which really had, I thought, jurisdiction over these.
Chair Metzger, Senator Deckert, you're correct. For a refresh to the bill, the Venture Capital Bill, Senate Bill 853, which we do have a technical amendment to. Yeah. We'll be coming back around on that. One thing to keep in mind is while the Oregon Innovation Council is focusing on forward-looking, high-wage, cutting-edge activity, the department still has a lot of work in the traditional business realm. The proposal that's before you now would focus on companies with high gross profit margins and pretty aggressive sales already in the hopper. So these are established businesses for the most part, and those which, again, as Mr. Wargren has testified, would be focusing on new activities that don't necessarily meet first wave of discussion with respect to or criteria with respect to risk management. On the other hand, we did take this proposal to the Innovation Council. And, John, do you want to go ahead and summarize the results of those conversations?
Yes, Senator Metzger, Chair Metzger, committee. We did do that, and in my mind, part of it was timing. We had the survey that came out, and was even though it was in November, we actually had a separate royalty paper that was done by our financial advisor, which I think was dated in May. We presented to the lending committee, and there were already a lot of things that were pretty reaching the final stage at the time we made the presentation. So I think that, from my perspective, was part of the issue. The other is, I think we're dealing, as Mike said, with a slightly different business group. It's the initial wave of Oregon Inc.'s activity was kind of new technologies, and then later I think they added in existing technologies and existing businesses that were new. And so there was sort of a shift and timing. So I think this recognizes more the new existing businesses that are not quite there from a standpoint of getting bank financing. It's a little different focus. It ties in more with what we do every day, but goes just a little beyond what statute allows us to do now.
Senator Scar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question about how this bill is put together. It looks like in Section 2 you have what you create, the mezzanine financing fund that appears to put together a loan program with an advisory council. And in Section 3, it looks like you create a multi-bank account that's within the fund with its own loan program, and it has a financing account board. Both you have an advisory council and an account board. Are we talking about two different loan programs? Are we talking about one loan program? That seems a little bit confusing.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I would agree and that it is confusing, and it's one of the problems you deal with when you're trying to put kind of everything on a couple of pages. They are, in my mind, two very different things. There's either a direct program that the department does, maybe in partnership with other in terms of a public-private partnership, but where it's really a direct lending program from the department. The other is more like we were talking to Noah about, a multi-bank kind of program where we would simply let them administer and run the program. We would do like we would do with our loan guarantee program. We would, if there were any losses, we would absorb that. Maybe we would have a participate with them in the decision making, but the giant share of the work and administration would be done by a public organization or a private organization, someone outside the department.
So we are talking about two
different things,
different
that we weren't settled on when we started with
this. Okay, two different distinct programs. One is
and to
to just add one comment that was made when we were talking about potential changes to the Oregon Growth Account to allow for more economic development activity, which may be coming forward, where consideration for jobs rather than return is a primary focus, that maybe there's an opportunity for more than one way to address this need or more than one type of program. And so we're trying to keep that open mind as we talk to different folks about it.
Let's follow up, Mr. Chair. So the plan then would be a $5 million deposit into the fund, the mezzanine financing fund. That's where the money would go, and then on a project by project basis, money could be rolled into the multi-bank account. Is that how I understand that would work, or would there be money that would be automatically appropriated to the multi-bank account?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, our initial thought was to what resources could the department bring to bear, and we looked at our OBDF fund, which was capitalized with $18 million, and we thought we could find $1 million there to help in some way and to partner with others. And talking to our financial advisor and others, including Oregon Inc.'s committee, they felt that we need at least $5 million to attract banks and others to partner with us on transactions. And so we've been exploring the idea of trying to find $4 to $5 million from some other source, banks or other funds somewhere that would get enough money together in a pot that you could use, and you could cut that different ways. Our current thinking is if we could do a private-public partnership where we could apply the $1 million from OBDF and have a $4 million investment from banks, let's say, that we could partner with would be maybe an ideal way to do this.
So that $4 million and the million from OBDF and the $4 million from the outside would go into the mezzanine account, or would it go into the multi-bank account?
This needs clarification. My understanding is the multi-bank account would be funds that would come from the other banks, and that might be the $4 million piece. That and our $1 million OBDF that would be available as a reserve, for example, would go into what's called a mezzanine fund.
So the only appropriation that the legislature would make would be the $1 million in the mezzanine fund?
Along with the authority to do this kind of financing?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
just one other quick question. Which Oregon Inc. committee, and did they take a vote on this?
It was more, Chairman Metzger, Senator Decker, it was more in the form of a PowerPoint presentation that we presented to it's not the lending committee,
Capital Formation
Committee. And we went through all of our various programs as a lead up to why we were talking to him about this kind of financing, and it was more in the form of a presentation and a reaction and interaction with the committee about how we might do this. There were angel investors as part of the committee and venture capitalists and others.
And they said
there wasn't a formal vote. It was more, my recollection was more in the form of encouragement. They didn't step up and say, you're part of our bigger program, and here's the $4 million set aside. Mm-hmm. But they did encourage us and wanted to circle back. I think their interest is more in the early stage, and we were looking at trying to do a more conservative approach with existing companies at that point. And so, royalty financing can be done in a broad range, and we're trying to narrow it in terms of reducing the risk to mezzanine financing, which is really closer to a bankable deal.
Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Hasina Squires, did I testify? Oh, I'm sorry. I have you down on 150. But I'm sure early in the session we all make mistakes. And
make your testimony we'll just, on this one.
I thought maybe the fire departments or something wanted to have some mezzanine financing. So, all right, so make the record note that Hasina does not want to testify on this one. And she's not signed up for 151, so the committee will make a decision as when that bill comes before us whether we'll allow her to do that. I think what we'll do, committee, is we'll hold off a little bit on this, get some other questions answered. Just one thing that stuck out to me a little bit as I actually read through the letter of the bill, Mr. Salzgiver, is that you have the two different fund, possibilities, and you have your advisory board, which is good. Usually in things that we do in the economic development world and what Senator Decker deals with a lot in the Revenue Committee, when we have different programs like this, we also establish, not all, but some, at least some criteria of which are to be applied for these. And none of that is in this bill. In other words, for example, with tax credits or things that we have worked actually with you on and other things in your other previous lives, you know, an establishment of certain goals, whether that's increasing employment, there's certain standards that have been established as goals of the department, and at least some of the base a criterion here or criterion there that need to be met to apply. And one thing I didn't see in the legislation, although the advisory board may certainly develop that, personally, I would like to see something to say, well, what is the goal objective of the plan, as opposed to just business as needed, but what is the public policy goal of why this is positive? What is the outcome, even on these small-scale business partnerships, that we believe would be achieved? I think that's just kind of helpful in establishing some understanding that if we were to go forward with this, that what the objective that we're trying to achieve and who, you know, might be those who would come, as opposed to, you know, being wide open to anybody. I just think that would be kind of helpful. And we'll talk about that and bring the bill back at a later time. But we'll talk about some of those types of things and also circle back with Senator Johnson, who, as you pointed out, had some concerns as well, and with the committee members, and we'll proceed at that point. Okay?
Very well, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 150, and we'll open a public hearing on our last bill of the day, Senate Bill 151. And you may go ahead and stay as Janet gives us the introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 151 is also at the request of the Department of Community and Economic Development and would extend the sunset date for the Oregon Enterprise Zone Program from the current sunset of June 30th, 2009 to June 30th, 2021. Mr. Chair, we did send around to your offices a list of existing Oregon Enterprise Zones. And you may recall some legislation last session that extended the number of Enterprise Zones that could be established. The department can update you on the effects of that legislation as well as the purpose of this bill. And the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Finance and Revenue Committee,
which the chair is sitting on. So, with that in mind, welcome again. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Salzgiver, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Economic and Community Development. Joining me is my colleague, Art Fish. Art manages the incentive programs for the business incentive programs for the department. And this is one of the key programs he spends a lot of his time on during the course of a year. I appreciate the opportunity to come to the committee today to discuss Senate Bill 151, which is an extension of the existing Enterprise Zone program for Oregon. Currently, if you look at line 6 of Senate Bill 151, you'll notice that there's a new date inserted that would change the sunset of this program from June 30th, 2009 to June 30th, 2021. So to extend the sunset date of this very successful program for an additional 14 years. This is the only change that the department is recommending in the bill. The program would still function as it has in the past, as revised by previous legislatures, including the 1995 reauthorization of the overall program. With this bill, as with past legislation, each of the current 55 zones around the state would still terminate after not more than 11 years. From the date that they were established. Redesignation of those zones would be available for previous local government sponsors or for other cities, ports, counties, special districts to apply and can still qualify for an enterprise zone with competitive evaluation among proposed zones as a possibility. In the last legislature, the number of zones available to the department was expanded by 10, And so this would allow us to continue to administer that program. I'd like to focus a little bit on the success of the program, the outcome of the program. And in this document, which I think you all have, is a summary of activity under Oregon's Enterprise Zones in 2006.
Actually, we do not have that.
You do not have that. Okay. Well, we'll be sure you get that.
But it's, I think it may be coming.
It's coming around, sir. Thank you. On the back is a map that shows where all the zones are around the state, and then inside is a fairly detailed report that Mr. Fish has prepared that show the results of the program to date. I'd like to point out a few highlights, though. The Enterprise Zone program in Oregon continues to be an essential and critical tool to us in inducing the retention, expansion, and recruitment of new businesses to the state by eligible businesses, and by eligible, generally non-retail businesses that have limited duration exemptions from property taxes on their new investments in plant and equipment, as well as other targeted benefits. The Enterprise Zone program increases local employment. In the last tax year, for example, 5,884 new full-time jobs were the direct result from 114 exempt projects, which cost about $1.3 billion. The program is considered cost-effective in terms of long-term tax revenue, as well as stimulating job creation and the state's traded sector economy, which is the focus by charge of the legislature and by charge of our commission, which has become a focus area for us in focusing on the traded sector economy. And it lines up well with the Oregon Business Plan, which we strongly support. And it includes areas that are economically lagging and can qualify for Enterprise Zone designation in the future. In fact, of the 55 existing zones currently in operation in Oregon, 46 of those are in rural areas. And in 2005, more than 1,200 new full-time jobs were created, and approximately $242 million was invested in Oregon's economy in 43 projects qualifying for exemption in that current tax year. So this has been a program that has shown very strong results. As I mentioned, it continues literally to this day to be a key tool in our toolbox for getting businesses to stay here, to grow here, and to come here. If we do not achieve this extension, I think it's fair to say that investment in business development projects around the state would become limited. Job growth throughout the state would be inhibited. All non-tribal enterprise zones, some of which have existed only a short period of time, would terminate and cease to exist as of June 30, 2009. Established tax abatement periods for business firms would end, and the ability of the state and targeted areas to promote and achieve greater economic development over the next decade would be severely impacted. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we thank you for the opportunity to testify about this bill today. It is an important one to us. It's an important program, and we look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Fish, do you have anything you'd like to add at this point?
Chair Metzger, my name for the record is Arthur Fish, Business Incentives Coordinator with the Department, and no, I have no actual comments myself. I'm just happy to receive your questions.
Okay, I think we may have some. What I think before we get to that, then I'll have ask you guys just to stand just right behind you and ask Doris Penwell and Hasina Squires to come forward, who are the other two people who have signed up on this bill, and get their comments, and then we'll go to questions once we have are all the issues out on the table. Ms. Penwell, we'll go with you first. Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I spend most of my time on economic development activities on behalf of the counties. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 151. The counties have been an integral part of operation of the program since its inception, and we've been with the department and the legislature every step of the way since it began. It, as you probably know, it is essentially a local program that is authorized by the legislature, and it is only used in localities that choose to use the program and apply for a zone. It is the department administers the program, but the zone sponsors, who may be cities, counties, or ports, are the folks that run the program at the local level. And over the years, we have worked with all of the taxing districts and businesses and whomever is interested in improving the program to make sure that it works for everyone and be sure that we're open and communicating among all of our entities. The program basically helps the areas of the state that have not achieved this economic success that some of the normal chosen few might achieve, and therefore it has helped to spread investment around the state. And I think some of the materials that were given to you by the department might tell you that. If you talk to folks that are zone managers, they can give you specific examples and the kind of data that will tell you what it's, where it's worked and where it may not have worked so well. Frankly, the program works where you put time in at the local level and you have folks that are innovative and market the program. And therefore, it is a key marketing tool for the state in achieving investment by either existing businesses or new businesses. I think we all, the folks that have worked in the program, believe that we have enough enterprise zones, and as I said, the ones that work the hardest on those zones are the ones that achieve the results. So the counties that do their work, the cities, the ports that do their work, achieve results. And of course, in some of those areas around the state where it's harder to do that work, they don't have so many investments, but at least it's there if they can use, if and there's an opportunity for them. That's about all I have to say, and I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Ms. Squires, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the 900 special districts that belong to our association. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today in opposition to Senate Bill 151. This enterprise zone program is not a program that we feel should be reauthorized without some additional reform to the program and a good hard look at exactly what kind of results the program is producing. I understand Economic Development Department feels that this program is functioning at a highly great level to create a bunch of additional jobs, and that the tax benefits that are bestowed upon all these companies are worthy of property tax exemptions at the local level. We, our association for several legislative sessions has been continually advocating, and I think, Senator George, you're the only one who is new this legislative session, but everyone else on this committee has probably heard the issue of the special district opting out of whatever types of property tax exemptions are created at the local level, not at the state legislative level. And with that, I mean, when there have been bills recently that have been advanced to increase the number of enterprise zones, special districts have come forward and asked that special districts be afforded the ability to opt out of those zones and make the choice whether or not they want to choose to have their property taxes preempted. We've been down that path for several legislative sessions, been successful in a few cases and unsuccessful in other cases. Following the conclusion of last legislative session, our board of directors felt that it was imperative that instead of coming to the legislature with hypotheticals and information that we may or may not know exactly what the cost-benefit analysis is about job creation and whether or not these zones actually function, our board decided to make a significant investment in obtaining actual data statewide in Oregon and contracted with Portland State University to provide such a study. And our study, I'm very sad to say today, is not complete. We expect it to be completed within the next couple of weeks and be able to have some actual data in the state of Oregon about exactly how much it costs to create one of these jobs. Is it $100,000 per job? And is that a policy decision that the legislature wants to make about capping the exemption that should be provided? I mean, how many dollars do we want to give a company to create one type of job? Some other things that I've only seen a very preliminary draft of the report. Some other things that we'd like to just raise a number of policy questions about this program to the legislature and have a full dialogue and discussion about whether or not this program is functioning properly and might be improved, not only for our benefit but also for businesses' benefit. There are a lot of hoops that they need to jump through in order to participate in this program. A lot of red tape. There's a lot of process involved in this program, and it is not, I would venture to say, very streamlined from any business's perspective. So we would ask that you withhold action on this bill today and afford us the opportunity to appear before you and provide some very comprehensive data, as I would describe it. There have been a lot of studies. I think Minnesota legislature took this issue on recently, and what they found was with relation to the question of would these zones actually, would they have invested without the zone? And when it's self-reported data, it's of course we wouldn't. And when it's independent analysis of that, yeah, the investment probably would have happened. And they're temporary jobs that are created temporarily while the exemption is there. And then when the exemption is gone, the jobs go away. So that's just one case from Minnesota. So this program has not had an outside look, an independent look at how it functions, and so we would appreciate the opportunity to provide you with that information prior to moving this bill.
Okay, well, a couple of things. Thank you, Ms. Quares. Just to clarify, from the clients that you represent and having heard in testimony before on some of these issues over the last couple of sessions in revenue and in the business committee, is it fair to say that, if not the only concern, one of the major concerns of the people you represent is that on a local level in these zones, they are often exempted, specifically fire districts and others, from the taxation and the concern that you still need to provide services without the revenue to provide those services. Is that a fair kind of policy position from where you come from?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. I think the policy position for the association has been we just want to fair – in the past – we just, without, you know, barring this whole discussion of whether or not this program functions properly or adequately, the discussion at our association and our policy position has been we would like the same seat at the table with the cities and counties and have the ability to choose whether or not we participate. If they get the ability to choose whether or not they're going to levy property taxes, we would like that opportunity also.
And another thing, I am actually very fascinated in your upcoming summary. Have you had the advantage, the who you have commissioned to provide this analysis, of either this document or something similar to it from the department, so you could weigh the two different perspectives in a comparison? Would that be something we might expect from you if we were to have you come back? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department at Portland State University has been working with the department, has requested a lot of information from the Economic Development Department, and they've been very forthcoming with their information. It's sort of how you get the information, how you go about asking the right question to get the right information. But yes, we fully expect to be able to bring you, for instance, a map of the state of Oregon that shows that this used to be a rural program and it's been migrating towards the I-5 corridor. I know Senator Mona Sanderson knows. Gresham is taking advantage. Hillsborough is taking advantage. Senator Starr knows. So we plan on bringing that type of information forward, too, as a policy discussion for you.
And questions of the committee, and certainly with our representative from OCDD, if you have questions for them as well, we'll bring them back up. So questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. Like you said, I'm fairly new to this, but let me just make sure I get straight. As these things go forward, they're similar to urban renewal districts where the local jurisdiction brings it forward and you and they bring it forward, and if it's approved, the local school districts, special districts, fire districts, water districts, others, then have their property taxes or other streams of revenue locked in. And where is your, is it, am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, they're different than urban renewal. Urban renewal can go on forever, and we're going to have a discussion about that also in our stuff from Portland State University.
The process is similar as far as locking your revenue.
However, the county and the city chooses to create and then applies to OEDD for a zone designation, and then OEDD reviews the criteria and whether or not they qualify, and they either grant or don't grant the zone designation, and then businesses apply within that zone designation for the exemption.
And if I could follow up real quickly. So, and then what happens is, are you guys, Are you guys involved at all in the process? I mean, currently, is there, I mean, do the cities and counties at this point just ignore the special districts because they don't have to listen to them? I mean, what is there any kind of requirement that they hold, at least bring you guys forward to make sure you participate in that process?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, this has been a long-standing debate, so Doris and I have to look at each other and laugh. In the past, not so, in our opinion, and probably Doris's opinion is different, in the past, no, not so much. In the present, better than before, and I can't cite off the top of my head an example of where a special district has been ignored. We worked with the department to develop, I believe in the administrative rule, there is notification of all taxing districts when a zone is created and that your property taxes will be exempted, and there's a great deal of communication that goes out to the taxing districts. So to answer your question shortly now, yes, we are communicated with, but we have no veto authority.
Chair, that's exactly what I was asking. At this point, there is nowhere in the process that you can guys say, hey, our budgets are tight right now, this is what's happened, and basically you're told that this is what will happen. You have no equal footing at all with other local jurisdictions that are creating this?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, a local government could choose to make could choose to provide some other financial incentive to a special district, and there are sharing agreements that do occur at the local level when everyone is involved in certain cases, but ultimately the answer is no.
Thank you.
Yes.
Could I make one other question about that question from Senator George, Mr. Chair? Many places around the state, when there is a significant investment through the Enterprise Zone program, and it is clear that services are required by the businesses to operate, there's an agreement made between the taxing authority that provides the service and to the business to provide in lieu of taxes payment so that the service district has funding to provide the services they need to provide over the short term of the incentive program. I want to remind you that the Enterprise Zone program is a 3 to 5 year property tax exemption on new investment, not on existing investment. So it's for the portion of the operation that is new, not everything else that's already there or on the land. So, but that's what they do. They clearly, a business has to meet code requirements, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to find one way or another to pay for services. And special districts aren't the only people that don't get the taxes in the short period. Everybody else doesn't either in a taxing situation. It's just that we hope that the investment will provide some further increase in the economic opportunity for the whole area as a result of both income taxes and property taxes paid.
Okay. This is, Mr. Chair, this is probably a question for Art, actually, Mr. Fish, if
sure.
I could.
Yes.
But as I read these charts, and again, this is a fairly new area for me, but as I read these charts that you've provided for us, there's a $1.5 billion of investment. But when I look at chart number 2 and chart number 4, it looks like to me that there are 5 projects that have provided basically $1 billion or two-thirds of the investment that we've identified. So there's 5 firms that, am I reading that correctly? If you look at chart 2, there's 5 projects that are more than $100 million. And then when you go to chart 4, when you look at the total value of those, that there's basically 5 firms that have dominated about 66% of these projects. Am I correct in that, or 5 investments? Or am I reading that incorrect?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, yes, you are reading that correctly. It's a kind of an important point about the way things work out in the real world of capital investments. This is a capital type of incentive because it's based on property taxes, as Doris pointed out, new plant and equipment. So it's only the new property that's being added and some, you know, mostly real property, heavy stuff, structural improvements. And if you look around the investments that are made generally, not just in enterprise zones, you have a small number of projects that may have a lot of jobs or less so, depending upon, that are very capital intensive. And it's kind of a nonlinear thing. And then as you go down the slope, there's hundreds of businesses that are making smaller investments that may not be very capital intensive, not very big. The enterprise zones still serve a lot of those types of projects. Can't provide them the same degree of benefit because they don't have the same property tax liability for the 3 to 5 year period. But that is true. I mean, if you count the number of projects
a lot of them are very small, relatively speaking, business investments by manufacturers or whatever. The number of jobs kind of splits out a little more evenly across these cohorts. This is a histogram, of sizes. And then if you go up to the small number of companies that are making giant investments, they tend to dominate the property value. And so those are the sorts of situations, often receiving five-year exemptions with special local approval by the zone sponsor, City, County, Port, that Doris referred to, where special arrangements are often made respective to any special district concern related to services relative to that type of new investment. So does that help you?
It does. Senator, can I follow up? Here's my guess, my problem with this concept generally, mm-hmm. is that as we've gone forward, we've seen this as a project for statewide significance. I mean, we as the legislature say we want this project to go forward, and somehow we see these jobs benefiting the state of Oregon. So if we create new jobs, those tax revenues then come to the state of Oregon, primarily because we're exempting the property taxes. So what we're trying to do is create jobs and then create some kind of income flow that then would create income taxes. But the jurisdictions that end up paying the price are the special districts, the school districts, the fire districts, and those others. So it seems like to me that there ought to be some kind of alternative form of funding in this, that if we as a state see this as primarily a state benefit, that Hasina's point is exactly made. They're paying the price for what we all see as a public benefit on the state level. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. And I'm asking, has there ever been any kind of investigation about how do we provide relief to our special districts? Because clearly, they're our frontline government that have most contact with our constituents.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I'll just try to comment on it. I can't really provide a definite answer, but I mean, some of the larger projects that dominate this do have statewide implications, and the department, for example, might be more involved with those projects than the vast number of things. But it's still a local project. The property tax revenue after the 3 to 5 year period will still overwhelmingly benefit local jurisdictions that are now taxing new structural and real property that may not have been there, some of which increasingly, to my surprise, appreciates in value year after year. So there are a lot of local benefits, and it has been sort of a local program as far as this particular benefit goes. There are other tax incentives that the state does offer and provide to help attract these kinds of companies, with irrespective of enterprise zones, sometimes in combination with them, with e-commerce and so forth. So the state income tax, corporate tax, is part of the system here as far as helping these things to go. But it is a local capital-based property tax benefit that the county, cities, and ports have chosen to see as a way to help these projects, big or small, move along and create jobs and tax base over the long term in that local area. So, whether you spread that out, and then the question of, well, what's the service impact of particular industrial-type development on special districts, and that's, kind of here and there. A lot of, if you look at the tax break as the overall share budget, it might not seem very large compared to all the taxes that are being received year after year on the vast number of residential properties and so forth in a given area. So those are all the things that have to be, I think, considered to address your issues.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in exactly what the, like Eugene, the total invested, I'm looking at on page 30, table D. Eugene, it's new, will give, total investment will be $531 million. And then, of course, Gilliam is 140. Then I jump down to the Lower Columbia Maritime, $679 million, and then North-Northeast Portland, $128 million, and then South San Diego, $108 million. So those are the, I think, the five that Senator George was referring to. And it sure would be interesting to know exactly what businesses. I mean, 209 jobs, 103 jobs for the Lower Maritime. Is that actually? Can you tell me exactly what industry was benefiting from that? I just need to get an idea of what kind of industry
Chair Metzger, Senator Mones and Anderson. This, specifically the numbers that Senator George were referring to, were actual exempt projects. These are proposed projects, but it's kind of the same. You know, it really doesn't matter. It's the same pattern year after year. You do get a few major projects, and this is an important issue with respect to this program, that are very large, and they will dominate, you know, in terms of future investments. Eugene, to be quite honest, is dominated. There's a couple new projects there, some of which are also very large, but the big chunk of that, half a billion dollars, is another reinvestment by the Hynix Corporation in a semiconductor plant there. Major employer, now the largest taxpayer of property taxes in Eugene, and one of the companies that we feel we'd never have down there if it were not for this kind of break on their initial capital costs and cash flow. Let's see, Gilliam County, those are windmills that are dominating the large figures. Now, there's lots of other companies, pharmaceuticals, lumber, call centers, the whole thing that maybe are lost in here as far as some of the smaller dollar figures. Lower Columbia Maritime, you know, I don't like to name a lot of companies in public, but that is the Georgia Pacific Wanamill, which is receiving an exemption. And let's see, what was the other one that you pointed out?
Oh, the North Northeast Portland and...
And again, you know, in some of these areas, you know, if you're talking about districts, you know, you always have a school district, but whether, you know, usually a sort of a fire district, except when you're in cities. And so the degree of special districts that are there and affected can vary from like zero in, say, the middle of Eugene to, well, I don't know, maybe Gilliam County has a couple. But some of these big projects, you know, it does vary from zero to like 10, 15, 20% as far as what's a special district that's affected. So it does vary across the map, but you said North Northeast Portland. That, I believe, is, you know, there's 12 projects, and I would say that's, I can't remember any particular one that fills up most of that 128 million. I really can't remember. I mean, I might be confusing them with projects from several years ago.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I just wanted to get a sense of what kind of industries this was going to, and it's obviously not any one particular one, but...
Well, it does, you know, in any given year, in any given zone, there's going to be, you know, investments that just dwarf everything else. And some industries, like power generation, semiconductor fabrication, and others, are extremely capital-intensive and just big. Other types of businesses have greater variance as far as, you know, the degree of size of projects and whatever. And, you know, I mean, you know, the auto industry is another one, but we don't have that, for example, represented at any of these in Oregon. But metals, big paper mills, but a lot of lumber, secondary lumber, those can be, you know, sizable, but not this kind of huge type projects, but still significant savings on property taxes for 3 or 5 years on $5 or $10 million investment. You get down to the vast majority of these projects that might be less than $2 million, and you know, one can wonder how much the property tax benefit made a difference to them as far as their investment. But you know, a lot of them are small businesses, and you know, everything helps. There you go.
Thank you.
That help?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
That's it. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Stark.
I really don't have a question on this, but I think, you know, we're going to have a number of, at least I expect, that we'll have a number of OECD-related bills. It might be worth spending a little bit of committee time just looking at all of the incentives that are available to businesses, and rather than just focus on one, kind of look at, you know, all of the opportunities that we have as a state to incent business to locate here and maybe make some judgments about those issues. So, as I thought.
No, that's a very good point. The I think there's a couple of things here as we look at this. I think there has been, my own personal view is that there has been a lot of good things that have happened because of the Oregon Enterprise Zone. I certainly have had some of those. I think everybody at the dais here in their districts have those. In some portion of their district have been in operation. But at the same standpoint, I think it is really, really important, I think as Senator Starr pointed out, to always step back and do that review You know, what were our objectives? Are we meeting the objectives? Is it universal? Is it the general trend or the exception? And Ms. Squires is going to provide some viewpoint on that that we can compare. And I think it is extremely valuable because we have this tool, which, keep in mind, does not do anything other than provide the authorization. And then there's another couple of levels going all the way down to the local governments who are going to be impacted by the lack of revenues for those services who ultimately make judgments. And so there's different layers of people to do review. But at the same standpoint, it is very important to see that as we have these collection of tools, you know, I mean, do they still meet the same criteria that we had before? Are they still going in the same way in which we want them to go? Are there lost opportunities or opportunities that would not be lost and maybe not in the same situation when the ideas were conceived? I know you mentioned the Lower Maritime one and Georgia Pacific, and not to pick on them, but we had that discussion about, you know, trying to retain jobs. And as you recall, it was only a few months later that they let off, you know, a lot of those workers. But the tax break goes on. So, you know, the general public sees some of these things and they ask questions, you know, about do we know really what we're doing here, and what are the provisions for participation, and if something doesn't work out, are there any other provisions in which districts then can do a reevaluation? I mean, I think those are just questions that need to be answered. I think we are really we're very fortunate in this committee is that we have the two leaders of our Senate Revenue Committee here on this committee. So I think Senator Starr's point is well taken. It's going to be well taking time to use some committee time once you get your evaluation to have that discussion, because I think that will also help all of you not having to beat the drum many, many times with the members of this committee. I think that's going to be really important. What I would ask, Ms. Squires, first of all, obviously we are on a time frame that we want to be as expeditious as possible. As you receive your material, what I would ask is that you share with all the committee members prior to the committee discussion so that they can have an opportunity to develop questions and use the committee time very productively. Also that, and I'm sure you would anyway, but see that Mr. Salzgiver and others also have preview copies of whatever will be presented to the committee so that the discussion will be as refined and focused as possible. I'll take your comment, and then we're going to hold the bill for that.
Oh, I was just going to mention, thank you again, and I do appreciate Senator Starr and Senator Deckard's work in the past on a lot of these tax incentives, and we'd be happy to review some of them that relate to income taxes or, you know, the Strategic Investment Program, which is the big sort of mega capital intensive type of thing that we have, and sort of differentiate where things fit in, what they can serve. Obviously, the enterprise zones is one of our more broader-based types of tools, and it does have job requirements, and, you know, that's going to possibly affect that Georgia Pacific thing, aside from their future investments that were treated under the SIP. And so we'd be happy to make the committee better informed about some of these tools and what they can and can't do, and maybe provide some indication of how some of our competitors are doing things, too.
That would be excellent. And so, Janet, I'll ask to work with Asina on the time frame for that. Senator Monas, I understand the question.
Just real quick, I know that if it wasn't for this program, we would not have gotten a big industry in Gresham. It was between Gresham and someplace in Florida. And because of the incentives that we gave, they decided to come to Oregon. So at least that's one instance in which we would not have that industry in our area.
Just one real quick general comment. I just, you know, as we look at where our state of our economy is today, you know, it's kind of we're on the upswing, you know, and everything's great. But now is not the time to let up. Now is the time to push even harder, because we know that, you know, how these processes work and the work that we're doing today will pay off in that next downturn. So keep up the good work.
Thank you very much for that. Well, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 151 and revisit the issue. Just two quick things. I'll have Janet give us a preview of our transportation meeting tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'll be a multimodal day. There is one bill on repealing the statutory requirements for that railroad inspectors have to meet. Those will be a dissatisfied rule instead. Senate Bill 139 is a notification of public use airports are about to close or give notification to the Department of Aviation. And then three trucking bills, with two of them deal with federal compliance with the safety inspection programs, and one has to do with the extra weight allowed for truck idling equipment that is necessary so they don't believe they can turn their trucks off and just keep the power unit going for refrigeration, et cetera, so they don't lose, allow them extra weight when they do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That'll be our agenda at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And since he has now arrived since our beginning of the committee, to inform, pleased to inform Senator George that Senate Bill 182 from the Board of Accountancy was passed by this committee. And as is tradition, we want to make sure that the integrity of the committee is upheld well on the floor of the Senate. So it is in your hands as the carrier of that bill to develop your persuasive skills and to make sure we're not embarrassed and that we have a very sound vote affirmative, and we'll look forward to your presentation of the bill on the floor, Senator George.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. I'm really looking forward to the honor.
Oh, yes. That's a good idea. Since he hasn't voted on the bill, I would ask unanimous consent to allow Senator George to vote on the bill.
Yeah. I think it's better if he didn't vote on it.
That's good. Okay, so I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 182 and ask Senator George how he would vote on the bill that he'll be carrying.
Aye.
So please record Senator George as an aye vote. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 182 and the committee is adjourned.
Nothing like voting on a bill you didn't hear. You didn't see. Yeah.